Hall and Katie Derham.
Petrock, good evening and a happy bank holiday Monday to you. Welcome to a real transatlantic humdinger of a prom here at the Royal Albert Hall. We are combining a rousing British first half of Walton and Butterworth and Arnold with an all-American second half, which should appeal to any of you who secretly yearn for the glitz and glamour of Broadway. I count myself among your number. American conductor Keith Lockhart is making his BBC Proms debut tonight. It's also his first concert in title as principal conductor of tonight's orchestra, the BBC Concert Orchestra, and we'll be hearing from him a little later on about his appointment. Keith has been principal conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra for 15 years. His background is just perfect for the repertoire and reputation enjoyed by the BBC Concert Orchestra. He'll be bringing some stateside pizzazz to that second half. We'll have music by Leonard Bernstein, George Gershwin, John Williams, another Boston Pops man, and a couple of Pops arrangements by Don Zubeski, one of which is an all-inclusive cinematic sing-along. You have been warned. It's a chance for the Royal Albert Hall audience to join in and let their hair down this Bank Holiday Monday, and I think you at home too, if the fancy takes you. But first, the British half. As I said, George Butterworth, Malcolm Arnold, and a new BBC commission written especially for this concert, and the Proms Family Orchestra, which is 199 amateur musicians from London and Cornwall squishing onto the stage here at the Albert Hall alongside the BBC Concert Orchestra. That will be a sight and a sound to behold. That's going to be a piece by Graham Fitkin, which he's called PK. Now, the applause that you can hear now is for the leader of the BBC Concert Orchestra, Cynthia Fleming. But let me tell you about the piece we're going to hear first of all. William Walton's Spitfire Prelude and Fugue, music he wrote for the 1942 film The First of the Few, a biopic of the designer of the Spitfire, R.J. Mitchell. With tragic irony, Leslie Howard, who directed and starred in the film, was shot down by the Luftwaffe on his way back from the Lisbon premiere in 1943. But coming onto the stage now to conduct William Walton's Spitfire Prelude and Fugue on the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain, here is the new principal conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra, Keith Lockhart.
Thank you.
Walton's Spitfire Prelude and Fugue, played with verve and vigour by the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by their new principal conductor, Keith Lockhart. And getting a rousing round of applause from the audience, but also from their new conductor. Well, from music depicting an iconic moment of the Second World War, we're going to turn now to George Butterworth's final orchestral work, a reflective idyll called The Banks of Green Willow, written in 1913 on the eve of the First World War.
Thank you.
The achingly beautiful Banks of Green Willow by George Butterworth, played there by the BBC Concert Orchestra. The solo violin you heard at the end was performed by the leader, Cynthia Fleming, and Keith Lockhart, the BBC Concert Orchestra's new principal conductor. That was a piece that was premiered by Sir Adrian Bolt in his first professional engagement, and it was the last piece of his own music that George Butterworth heard before going off to war. He was killed at the Somme in 1916 and was awarded a posthumous military cross. Well, if you've just tuned in, good evening. You're listening to BBC Radio 3 with me, Katie Derham, live at the Proms from the Royal Albert Hall here in London. The BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart are going to move on now to the first of two pieces with a Cornish connection. Malcolm Arnold moved to Cornwall in 1965 and soon became a convert to Cornish life, in particular the way music making was very much a living tradition. "I'm certain," he said, "that such an organisation as a Cornish youth brass band not only does so much good for talented young musicians, but its influence will also be far larger in a social sense." Well, after the success of his sets of English and Scottish dances in the 1950s, Arnold wrote four Cornish dances that really draw out all of the atmosphere of that musical tradition in Cornwall. As he said himself in the preface to the score, "a land of male voice choirs, brass bands, Methodism, May Days and Moody and Sankey hymns." Coming back to the platform now to conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra in Malcolm Arnold's four Cornish dances, their new principal conductor, Keith Lockhart. Malcolm Arnold conducted the premiere of his Cornish Dancers at the Proms in 1966. It was played then by the London Philharmonic, Arnold's old orchestra in which he'd been a trumpeter. But it was played for us tonight here at the Proms by the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Keith Lockhart, who's just brought the orchestra to their feet to take the applause from the audience. Now, there is going to be a huge stage reset here at the Albert Hall because the BBC Concert Orchestra is about to be joined by nearly 200 members of the Proms Family Orchestra and Chorus, people from London and the South East and from Cornwall who signed up to a series of workshops in order to take part in this prom. Malcolm Arnold, I think, would surely have approved of this ongoing community music-making project. Now, as I said earlier, this is a transatlantic concert of two halves, and this next piece makes the link. It's all about crossing the Atlantic after a fashion. It's called simply PK, just those two letters. And here is composer Graham Fitkin to tell us why.
Because I was asked to write a piece for musicians in Cornwall and musicians in London who weren't going to get together until just before the performance, plus a concert orchestra of professional musicians and these other amateur musicians, if you like, I suppose I wanted to think about a theme which was had something to do with communication of some sort. I also wanted to have something which was particularly Cornish, and it just so happens that the beach, which is very close to where I live, used to be the hub, the worldwide hub of telegraphic communication, and it's called Porthcurno, and its code name, given to it by Cable and Wireless, who ran it from the 1870s onwards, is PK. So PK stands for Porthcurno, and when telegraphs first left this country, they would go under the beach through cables to Bombay or to wherever via Porthcurno. So there was a sort of Victorian internet link, if you like. They've still got the machinery there which shows that. And in fact, the pathways which they use for the telegraph communication are still there today for internet now. So those same pathways are now fibre optic pathways going out to the States and going all over the world. And so when you make a mobile phone call, although you might think it's just bounced off satellites, in fact, if it's going to the States or abroad, generally, at some point, it'll go underground, under the sea, through a cable, although it's a mobile device. So it's still relevant today. The material for the music comes really from Morse code, which was the language which the early telegraph network used.
Fascinating stuff there from composer Graham Fitkin explaining the meaning of the title of his piece, PK. And it's the first time his music is going to be performed at the Proms, so a big night for him too. Now, it was one of life's amazing coincidences that when Graham was telling the performers in the Family Orchestra in Cornwall the story behind his piece, one lady put her hand up and said it was actually her grandfather who pressed the button in Porthcurno that sent the message to Marconi in America.
I'm Stephanie Clark, and my grandfather was called Thomas Jenkin Barron, and he worked with Marconi. He was a radio officer, and when they were doing the very, very first transatlantic signal, Marconi was actually in Newfoundland receiving the signal, and my grandfather was the person who keyed in the signal and sent it from, it was Poldhu in Cornwall. So it's a sort of remote part of Cornwall, actually, but an uninterrupted stretch of sea all the way to Newfoundland. The very first ever transatlantic signal. And he sent three dots, which represents the letter S. When I joined up to take part in the orchestra, I knew that the piece was going to have a Cornish theme, but I had no idea that it was going to be about Morse code. So it was really exciting because I felt that it was really special that I was going to be there. It was a complete coincidence.
Stephanie Clark from the Proms Family Orchestra. And the stage is filling up. It's packed with children and grown-ups of all ages, all generations. In fact, so many that we're going to have several sub-conductors on stage. In fact, they're all beginning to come on now. They're going to be trying to keep all the different sections together, partly because of the difficult sight lines, obviously, from where Keith Lockhart is standing on the conductor's podium. He's actually in front of quite a lot of the musicians. So he's got sub-conductors who are going to help him out. And one of them is Lincoln Abbott, former learning manager of the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Proms, now chief executive of Music for Youth.
The Proms Family Orchestra and Chorus was a BBC initiative that was started around about 5 years ago. And we just had the idea that there were lots of things for young people to do on their own, lots of things for their parents to do on their own.
Thank you.
The world premiere there of Graham Pipkin's PK, a telegraphic code name for Porthcurno in West Cornwall, the epicentre of Victorian global communications. And that piece played by the BBC Concert Orchestra and the Proms Family Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Keith Lockhart, but also by, well, I think I counted 11 other conductors on stage. One of them was Lincoln Abbott, who we heard from just before the performance, talking about this fantastic and huge multi-generational orchestra. There were various other members of the BBC Concert Orchestra taking on some conducting roles there. Also, Graham Pipkin, the composer, was standing just behind Keith Lockhart conducting as well. If you can just picture the scene, just imagine we have 46 extra violins and violas all standing to play. There was no way they could sit down. The cheer you're hearing there is for Graham Pipkin, who looks thrilled with the response he's got for this. But no, just to go back to the scene in front of me, because we've got players here, some as young as well, some of them look no more than six or seven, playing so well all together, but crammed onto this stage next to the BBC Concert Orchestra. We've got 32 extra brass, 26 extra woodwind, the brass twinkling up in the choir stalls there at the back of the Royal Albert Hall stage, and then this large family chorus too. What an experience for them. They clearly don't want to leave the stage after that. Keith Lockhart is coming back on now to take another bow and is warmly applauding all the musicians, both professional and amateur, young and old, bringing them to their feet again. Fantastically challenging piece of work commissioned by the BBC. And taken on by Graham Pipkin, who's getting a warm hug now from conductor Keith Lockhart and taking his bow again here at the Royal Albert Hall, his Proms premiere and Proms debut. The percussionist who you heard at the very beginning of that piece is getting a huge round of applause now, and if you can imagine, the most outrageous punk spiky hairstyle on a boy of about, what, 13? Terribly smartly dressed, but with this extraordinary hair. Well, what an event that was for everybody taking part and everybody here in the Royal Albert Hall. They're now leaving the stage and it's almost time for the interval, but after the break we have musical offerings from America, including the symphonic dancers of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, a couple of Boston Pops pieces by master arranger Don Sobeski, who I've heard is here in the audience at the Royal Albert Hall. But now it is time for that interval, and time for writer and family man Ian Sansom to take the opportunity of a trip to a swimming pool to reflect on the significance of learning to swim.
There are four swimming strokes currently recognised in the Olympics. They are freestyle, usually front crawl, breaststroke, backstroke, and the butterfly. The race known as the individual medley, or IM, is made up of all four of these strokes combined, done in a particular order. First the butterfly, then the backstroke, followed by the breaststroke, and finally freestyle. What follows is, if you like, an individual medley on the theme of swimming. Every Thursday, for about 5 years, I would take my children, after a traditional light supper of baked beans on toast, to our local leisure centre for swimming lessons. Three children, different ages, different stages, made for three different half-hour lessons over the course of an evening, plus getting there, getting changed, getting dry, coming home. So it was about a three-hour round trip. And if I added up the total for all those years, I reckon I probably spent more time taking my children to swimming lessons than I spent reading to them, playing with them, or tending to their maths homework. Definitely more than tending to their maths homework. Sitting and sweating with all the other parents on the narrow, damp benches up in the echoing viewing gallery gave me a lot of time to think and a lot of swimming pool coffee machine coffee to drink. And often, or sometimes at least, when I wasn't thinking about giving up on the whole enterprise and letting them stay home and bone up on their trigonometry, I would think about swimming. Water plus time equals reverie. What were we doing there? Why were we doing this? Why was I putting them through it? The tears, the protests, the tiresome ritual of the rinsing of the trunks and the washing of the chlorinated towels, the verrucas, the perpetual colds. Was it just for the glory? For the badges? 25 metres, 50 metres, 500, a mile, in pyjamas? When would I be satisfied? What was the purpose? It's not immediately obvious. Swimming, when you think about it for a moment, is odd. It's unnecessary. It does not, for example, offer great career prospects. One thinks about these things as a parent. It can be a job, of course, or a part of a job. I have a friend who's a diver and who seems to spend most of his life in and underwater. But it's no more likely that my children's swimming lessons are going to inspire them to a life of deep-sea derring-do than their piano lessons are going to make them into a Daniel Barenboim or an Alfred Brendel. Which leaves swimming, really, only as an amusing leisure activity, something one does to pass the time, a hobby, or maybe, more seriously, as a sport or a form of keep fit. Maybe the children will end up joining the swimming team and swimming in competitions. They have not, I should say, ended up joining the swimming team and swimming in competitions, which may simply be because I set such a bad example. Personally, I've never been interested in teams or competitions of any kind, which may explain my long, lonely career drift and why I always had enough time to take the children swimming for 3 hours a week, not including recreational swimming, which probably bumped the total up to around 6 or 8 hours. I have not, career-wise, put in the necessary lengths, have not headed out for clear, open, professional waters. I have not perfected my stroke. But then I don't think that's what learning to swim is really about. I think learning to swim is about something else entirely. I think it's about learning to stay afloat. And I do mean literally staying afloat, of course. The early 16th century treatises on swimming, Nicolaus Weinmann's The Swimmer or A Dialogue on the Art of Swimming, and Everard Digby's De Arte Natandi, are really all about avoiding drowning, which is something any sane person would want to do. And unless one intends one's children to become hermits living high on a hill, it behoves one to prepare them for life's depths and watery prospects. Even living up a mountain, after all, they might fall into a well, as in the children's classic story, Tiki Tiki Tembo No Say Rembo Chari Barry Ruchi Pip Peri Pembo, in which a mother comes bitterly to regret having bestowed a multi-syllabled name upon her youngest son when he falls into a well and it takes her other son a long time to spell out the problem. There is a value and a purpose to learning to swim, however, that seems more significant and symbolic than the merely practical and precautionary. When I say that learning to swim is about learning to stay afloat, I'm thinking about that famous poor chap in Stevie Smith's poem who was too far out and not waving but drowning. He was trying to tell us something before he slipped down 40 feet below. But what? Stevie Smith, by the way, according to her biographers, was an original wild swimmer. She loved to swim in Hertfordshire rivers. Writers have long been fascinated by swimming. Jane Austen loved swimming, Sir Philip Sidney, Gerard Manley Hopkins, Swinburne, who took a perverse pleasure in swimming, as he took a perverse pleasure in most things, Coleridge, Pushkin, Flaubert, Rupert Brooke, "Come prepared for bathing," he would write to friends from the vicarage at Grantchester. Walt Whitman, he loved a dip, and Goethe, who liked to swim in the river that flowed along the bottom of his garden in Weimar. Iris Murdoch, John Bailey famously made a primitive kind of plunge pool in a derelict greenhouse for her, she loved swimming so much, which he filled with rainwater, some tench and some carp, and stuck in some immersion heater elements and called it Iris's Wallow, a place where the two of them could splash about and sing to one another a song they'd invented. Waterbird, waterbird, I love you. Waterbird, waterbird, hoo, hoo, hoo. Zelda Fitzgerald loved swimming and boys. Christopher Isherwood, ditto. And this is not even to mention the very dampest of the romantics, Shelley, who never actually learnt to swim, but who worshipped water and who loved nothing better than to undress and sit on the rocks, read Herodotus and then jump in a fountain, and Byron, whose legendary swim on the 3rd of May 1810 from Europe to Asia across the Hellespont Strait, doubly legendary in the sense of being in honour of the legend of Hero and Leander, is often regarded as the beginning of open water swimming as a recreational activity. I have a little theory about why so many writers are interested in swimming, and let me float it here for you with the assistance of W.H. Auden, who loved swimmers more than he loved swimming, divers and lounging sunbathers featuring often in his poems. In a review in 1933, Auden asked, "What is a highbrow? Someone who is not passive to his experience, but who tries to organise, explain and alter it. Someone, in fact, who tries to influence his history. A man struggling for life in the water is, for the time being, a highbrow." Writers, highbrows, struggling in the water, attempting to organise, to explain, to alter things. This rage for order, the attempt to stay afloat, is probably most obvious in poetry, with metre and poetic structure clearly serving as some kind of defence against flux and chaos. In writing verse, a poet must both submit to and master basic rules and techniques. Like swimming, you must learn a stroke and achieve regular and rhythmic movements. Iambs, trochees, sonnets, sestinas, metre and verse forms, one might say, are a way of preventing the tumult and flood of ideas and language simply overwhelming the poet. Swimming is all about triumphing over something, and that something is usually oneself. When we swim, therefore, we are escaping from something, the earth, the land, our clothes, ourselves, into something else. Sándor Ferenczi, the brilliant and eccentric Hungarian disciple of Freud, in his book Thalassa, Theory of Genitality, 1938, associates our fascination with water with the distant pull of the waters of the womb, what he calls our striving towards the aquatic mode of existence abandoned in primeval times. When Aschenbach on the Venice Lido watches Tadzio emerge from the sea, writes Thomas Mann, "It conjured up mythologies. It was like a primeval legend handed down from the beginning of time, of the birth of form, of the origin of the gods." Water is what lubricates our imaginations. It is our fundamental working fluid. In his book Water and Dreams, an essay on the imagination of matter, first published in 1914, the philosopher Gaston Bachelard traces the ways in which water inspires reverie and epiphany in writers and thinkers, pulling us back and driving us forward with its undertow. Paul Valéry, in one of his journal entries, makes a direct connection between swimming and the imagination. "I discover and recognise myself when I return to this universal element. My body becomes the direct instrument of my mind, the author of its ideas. To plunge into water, to move one's whole body from head to toe in its wild and graceful beauty, to twist about in its pure depths, this is for me a delight only comparable to love." Water, then, as the wellspring of the imagination, as love, as freedom, and as oblivion. Among writers and philosophers, swimming seems to offer access to, and an image of, heightened awareness, an imagining of complete rest and repose, an image of the overcoming of threats and challenges, a harking back to the womb and a vision of death. The very wise Ivan Illich, in his book H2O and the Waters of Forgetfulness, remarks that water has a nearly unlimited ability to carry metaphors. And, one might add, plots, which is presumably why there are so many films about swimmers and swimming, the greatest of which, of course, is The Swimmer, the 1968 work of mainstream semi-surrealism, directed by Frank Perry and starring Burt Lancaster, based on the short story by John Cheever. In the film, as in the story, the main character, Ned Merrill, played by Lancaster, decides to swim home through the swimming pools of his wealthy neighbours in suburban Connecticut. The Swimmer is a film about loss and despair and self-deception, during the course of which Burt Lancaster becomes increasingly wide-eyed and demented and runs around in a field with horses to a lachrymose soundtrack by Marvin Hamlisch and is shamed and rebuffed by everyone he knows, eventually returning home in a thunderstorm to a deserted house. "I'm swimming home," he tells his debauched, half-drunken friends. "Nothing's turned out the way I thought it would." The Swimmer strips a man naked, who is already stripped naked, except for his Speedos. There are plenty of other great swimming and pool scenes in cinema history, the beginning of The Graduate and Sunset Boulevard, the whole cockamamie plot of Ron Howard's Cocoon, but one could hardly talk about the history of cinematic swimming without mentioning Johnny Weissmuller in the Tarzan films of the 1930s. Which seemed to play endlessly and repeatedly on TV during the long, hot, landlocked summers of my own childhood. As every schoolboy knows, or used to know, Johnny Weissmuller, born Johann Peter Weissmuller in 1904, was a Hungarian-born German-American who won 5 Olympic gold medals and 52 US national championships, setting 67 world records. And then he played Tarzan. The nature of celebrity has clearly changed. These days, an Olympic athlete is more likely to endorse products, say whole grain cereals, than to take up an acting career. Actors act. Swimmers swim. It's our loss. Other actors had played Tarzan before, but Weissmuller made the part his own, partly with his own distinctive yell, which, if one is to believe some accounts, was created by splicing together a number of recordings of a soprano, an alto, and a hog caller. There have been other great swimmers, people to admire. Clarence Lyndon Buster Crabbe, another swimmer turned actor, who won a gold medal in the 1932 Olympics in the 400-metre freestyle and who went on to play Flash Gordon and Billy the Kid and Buck Rogers on TV and in film. And, of course, the great Briton, Captain Matthew Webb, who made the first observed and unassisted channel swim in August 1875, smothered in nothing but porpoise fat, a moustache and a distinctive red silk swimsuit. When Captain Webb eventually limped out of the sea near Calais, he complained merely of a slight sensation in his limbs, similar to that after the first day of the cricket season. The poet Swinburne regarded Webb's achievement, Webb's feat, as it were, as the greatest glory that has befallen England since the publication of Shelley's greatest poem. "Its hero is the only man among strangers to me personally in England that I would go much out of my way to shake hands with." But Webb's fame became a curse. Condemned to a life of exhibition swimming, he eventually came up with a money-making scheme to solve all of his problems, a swim in the Whirlpool Rapids below Niagara Falls, which he reckoned could make him $10,000 and set him up for life. Webb jumped into the icy waters on July the 24th, 1883, wearing his lucky red silk costume. He was dead within minutes. There is a swimmer, bolder than Captain Webb, crazier even than Burt Lancaster in The Swimmer, whose exploits tell us much about the true meaning of swimming. I mean, of course, the alcoholic, horseburger-chomping, flamenco guitar-playing, former professional gambler Martin Strel, the Slovenian endurance swimmer best known for swimming the entire length of various rivers, including the Danube, the Mississippi, the Yangtze and the Amazon. Strel's motto is swimming for peace, friendship and clean waters. It might as well be swimming for dear life. The documentary film about his Amazon River adventure, Big River Man, is a portrait of a descent into madness. Over the course of the 5,000-kilometre swim, you see Strel descending into the very vaults of his being. The swim, in 2007, took 66 days, but much longer for Strel to recover. He seems to swim as a pilgrimage and as punishment and as purgation. Charles Sprawson, in his History of Swimming, Haunts of the Black Masseur, argues that much of a swimmer's training takes place inside his head, immersed as he is in a continuous dream of a world underwater. So intense and concentrated are his conditions that he becomes prey to delusions and neuroses beyond the experience of other athletes. Which you might think would put people off. On the contrary, books proliferate. Wild Swimming by Daniel Start, Roger Deakins' Waterlog. Major open water swimming events now include the so-called Great Swims in Britain, the Waikiki Rough Water Swim in Hawaii, the Rottnest Channel Swim in Australia, and the Round the Castle Swim in the canals of downtown Copenhagen. On a recent trip to Paris, I was surprised to see a group of men and women, early on a Sunday morning, merrily swimming down the Seine. Now that the children no longer need me to take them to lessons, I have taken up swimming again myself. But I avoid the pool, too many bad memories. I like to get up early and ride out on my bike down to the sea and slip quietly, shivering, into Belfast Lock. I'm not an elegant swimmer. My style is reminiscent of the description in the Times of the Native Americans who came to England in 1844 to compete against Captain Webb and who lashed at the water with their arms like the sails of a windmill. I swim like Don Quixote. And I still find it shocking, swimming. It's always as if I'm a child again. The massive assault on the senses, the rhythmic succession of sounds, my hands cutting through the water, rushing under my body and over the face, muffling me, silencing me, terrified, alone and at peace. I am in love with moistness, says Maggie Tulliver in The Mill on the Floss, before drowning.
And that was Ian Sansom on Learning to Swim. And the programme was produced in Bristol by Sarah Davis. You're listening to BBC Radio 3 with me, Katie Derham, live at the Royal Albert Hall in London. We're not going to swim. Neither will we be sending messages via Morse code. Instead, we will let America report to us here at the Royal Albert Hall. We have music by Bernstein, by Gershwin and by John Williams to come. And on stage tonight, the BBC Concert Orchestra with their new principal conductor, Keith Lockhart, who's making his proms debut.
Well, I've had the pleasure of conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra for a couple of seasons now. And I have to say guest conducting is a little bit like dating. Sometimes you want a second date and sometimes they say, I'll call you, and it never happens again. But I have to say, in this case, I've had from the very beginning a wonderful, joyous experience working with this group. For one thing, it is one of the most fantastically virtuosic and agile orchestras I've ever had the pleasure to work with. They get everything right very quickly, and they demand a lot of their conductor, and it's a musical thrill to work with them. I think also I really like the position that the BBC Concert Orchestra has in British and indeed the world's musical life, in that, in a way similar to my best-known podium in America as conductor of the Boston Pops, they are an orchestra that really specializes in playing everything, the widest possible variety of musical expression, but all without compromise, all at a very high level. And so with this orchestra, you can do a great, very strictly classical concert on one day and turn around and, well, work with somebody like Johnny Greenwood, for instance, or a jazz program or Broadway or anything, and they do all of it with a great sense of style and a great sense of flair. And I find this the most telling thing when I'm looking at what truly makes a virtuoso orchestra. Anyway, they're a great bunch of ladies and gentlemen, and I'm really looking forward to the experience that lies in the years ahead.
And I think he's already enjoying his experience tonight. Keith Lockhart there, the new principal conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra. I should mention that in the audience tonight we also have Johannes Wildner, the orchestra's new principal guest conductor. And Barry Wordsworth, conductor laureate, is here as well. Now, we're going to be hearing the symphonic dances from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story. The original show ran for 732 performances when it opened on Broadway in 1957. It was a landmark in American theatre. Here comes Keith Lockhart to conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra in Bernstein's Symphonic Dances now.
Thank you.
Wonderful stuff. The poignant finale of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, Symphonic Dancers. The merest hint there of reconciliation between the two rival gangs, the Jets and the Sharks. Isn't that fantastic? The BBC Concert Orchestra, led by Cynthia Fleming, and conducted by their new principal conductor, the American Keith Lockhart. bringing the orchestra to their feet, and quite rightly too. Wonderful display of rhythmical vitality. I love the percussion in that, and just watching them go, my goodness, they work hard during that piece, during those 9 sections. You know, apparently the orchestrators of that piece were worried about straight orchestral players coping with the jazzier elements of the score when they were working on it. But Bernstein, who had a foot in both camps, had no such worries, and it doesn't seem to cause any problems for the supremely versatile BBC Concert Orchestra tonight. And in rehearsal this afternoon, I have to say, Keith Lockhart said he'd never heard an orchestra play that so well, especially in a first rehearsal. They really like playing for him too, you can tell. It was very interesting. He's a very clear conductor, very neat, doesn't use a baton, but has just that right amount of bounce and brio, if you like, and clearly is establishing a very good relationship with them. Now, we are going to have 2 Don Sobeski Boston Pops arrangements next. Short piece by Keith Lockhart's predecessor in Boston, the legendary John Williams. But first, a short classic from the pen of George Gershwin, Shall We Dance?, which came out in 1937, just 2 months before Gershwin's death at the tragically young age of 38. It was the latest release from RKO for their biggest stars, the famous partnership of Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, and featured songs such as Let's Call the Whole Thing Off and They Can't Take That Away From Me. This short comic dance sequence with Fred Astaire walking the dog on the deck of a cruise liner. I know you know it. It's a great scene. Here comes Keith Lockhart back to the stage of the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra in Gershwin's Promenade Walking the Dog from Shall We Dance? Gershwin's Walking the Dog from Shall We Dance? And the clarinetist Michael Piers is being brought to his feet by conductor Keith Lockhart there, quite rightly too. More film music next, this time by John Williams, and this is his Flight to Neverland from the Peter Pan film Hook. Thank you. Flight to Neverland from Hook, written by John Williams. Surely the most celebrated living film composer. And he was Keith Lockhart's predecessor at the Boston Pops, currently their conductor laureate. Well, the audience certainly enjoyed that, but they're going to have to get a good voice for this next piece, because it is a fantastic medley by Don Sobieski, and it is a sing-along, a cinematic sing-along. So get ready at home. I should say the words are in the programme notes on the BBC Proms website, so you can find them there. Do enjoy it. that's got to be a first. 5,000 of us here at the Royal Albert Hall singing along with Keith Lockhart and the BBC Concert Orchestra. He's good. He's good. He had us singing. He had us swaying. We were clapping. We were almost not English. That was As Time Goes By. It was Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Moon River, The Way We Were, Que Sera Sera, Zippity-Doo-Da, and finally, Over the Rainbow, all put together in that wonderful Hooray for Hollywood medley by Don Sebesky. That definitely has been the highlight of the evening so far. It took a little while for everybody to warm up, but by the end, I think everybody was singing. We're going to finish with another Sebesky special, this time the title song from the 1933 Warner Brothers musical 42nd Street. And here comes Keith Lockhart to conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra. Thank you. the Don Zabeski arrangement of 42nd Street. Now, if you were wondering what that huge cheer and round of applause in the middle of that performance was, it's because the multi-talented percussion section of the BBC Concert Orchestra actually played white tap shoes held up on long sticks against a black background to the surprise of the audience here. I tell you, is there anything they can't do? It was the brainchild of Alistair Molloy, one of the principal percussionists of the BBC Concert Orchestra, and he went to Keith Lockhart and said, "I've had an idea, what do you think? Should we do it?" And he said, "Yeah, let's do it." Keith Lockhart's first prom in his role as principal conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra. What a reception, and how much he seems to enjoy it. There really is nothing quite like the BBC Concert Orchestra, what they've done tonight. Bernstein, Butterworth, they've even tap danced. You know what? I think we're going to hear them do it again. A lot of showmen there are on the stage tonight. The percussion section, I don't think I've ever had a reception like it. Keith Lockhart giving them an I'm not worthy bow for their tap dancing in 42nd Street, their homage to Busby Berkeley here at the Proms. It's been quite the entertaining night, hasn't it? Feels like Bank Holiday Monday is music night here at the Royal Albert Hall. A reprise there as an encore of Don Zabeski's 42nd Street. It was the Boston Pops arrangement, and the new principal conductor of the BBC's Concert Orchestra, Keith Lockhart, was, of course, and still is, the conductor at the Boston Pops. A real pizzazzy showbiz feel to tonight's second half, which we have all thoroughly enjoyed. And I should say that the cello section, not to be outdone by their mates in percussion, gave us a bit of a twirl in the middle of playing. They twirled their cellos round in a particularly flamboyant fashion. Nice work. But as Keith Lockhart comes on to take yet another bow and the cheering continues, I'm afraid that is it for tonight. The BBC Concert Orchestra will be back though here at the Proms on Sunday afternoon with Paul Daniel when they recreate Sir Henry Wood's Last Night of the Proms from 1910. That will be at 2:30 in the afternoon. BBC Radio 3 will be back tomorrow night, of course, live at 7 o'clock for a performance of Engelbert Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel, Alice Coote and Lydia Teusche in the title roles, with the Glyndebourne Festival Chorus and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by young hotshot Robin Cicciati. But for now, from me, as I get my tap shoes on, I will wish you a good night from the Royal Albert Hall in London and hand you back to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House. Good night.
Katie, thank you. Katie Derham there at the Royal Albert Hall. Just imagine if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, back to this evening, and in 10 minutes' time, the Lebrecht interview. Norman Lebrecht talking tonight to Clive Gillinson, the famous former director, managing director, I should say, of the London Symphony Orchestra. He's now the artistic director of New York's Carnegie Hall. That's at 9:15. Until then, well, as Katie mentioned, Glyndebourne Opera brings Humperdinck's children's opera for grown-ups, Hansel and Gretel, to the proms tomorrow night. The piece, such a favourite, just about everything else Humperdinck wrote, never seems to get a look in, does it? This is music from his opera Königskinder, the Royal Children. It's the introduction to Act 3, the minstrel's last song, a lament that sounds the Royal Children's unhappy end. Karl Anton Rickenbacker conducts the Bamberg Symphony Orchestra. Isn't that close? Sublime. Karl Anton Rickenbacher conducting the Bamberg Symphony Orchestra in the introduction to Act 3, The Minstrel's Last Song, from Engelbert Humperdinck's fairy tale opera Königskinder. And Glyndebourne Opera brings Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel to the proms tomorrow night, live in the Royal Albert Hall, and as ever here on Radio 3, and a 7 o'clock start for that. Back to this evening, just gone 9:15, time now for this week's Lebrecht interview with Norman Lebrecht.
Sir Clive Gillenson's is a classic British story of rags to artistic riches. Like Andrew Carnegie in the 19th century, he started out as a humble artisan and wound up at the head of the world's greatest concert hall. How do you get to Carnegie Hall, asked the tourist. Practice. Practice, said the New York cop. I shall be asking the hall's executive and artistic director if that's all it takes. Born in Bangalore, India, Gillenson started piano at 7, the cello at 11, and worked his way first into the Philharmonia Orchestra, then into the London Symphony Orchestra, where he became a popular and pivotal player. In 1984, when the LSO almost went bust, Gillenson laid down his cello to become emergency finance director and later chief executive. In 20 years at the helm, working with such personal heroes as Claudio Abbado, Leonard Bernstein, Colin Davis, Mstislav Rostropovich, he propelled the orchestra to a position of unheralded prosperity. 5 years ago, he was recruited as head of Carnegie Hall. He's here in a BBC studio to tell me how it's done. Clive, you and I have known one another through the worst of times and the best. Looking down now from this pinnacle of artistic influence and public recognition, Carnegie Hall, the knighthood, did you ever imagine it could have ended so well?
Well, firstly, I never wanted to be a manager. So that answers your question. I never imagined it, in other words. But I could never have imagined, even when I was managing the LSO, it was never in my wildest dreams I thought that I would ever run Carnegie Hall. But then, as I say, it had never been an aspiration. I remember because in my mother's side of the family, people had been musicians forever, all the way back through our family. And I remember when I went into the LSO office and started managing the LSO, I mean, really by mistake, that I remember her complete bafflement that I could stop playing the cello, even temporarily at that stage, because she thought the only thing that mattered in life was to play music all your life. And she was still practicing when she was 90.
Let's go back to beginnings. How did you come to get born in Bangalore? Your parents got married in Palestine just after the war.
Well, complicated. Do you know, I'm not even absolutely sure where they were married. They met in Palestine during the war because, in fact, my mother left Europe with the rise of the Nazis. And so she spent the war, in fact, playing the cello all around Palestine, Egypt, everywhere to the British troops and so on. And my father was in Iraq during the war and with the British Army, and he went there, he heard her play the cello, fell in love with her, proposed to her the next day. And in fact, I think they may have got married in India. I'm not even sure. But then we went to India because his parents had business interests there, and that's where I was born.
Your mother, Regina, was a very good cellist, wasn't she?
She was a wonderful cellist.
Professionally through her life, through three marriages.
Yeah, I mean, she was a fantastic cellist. And in fact, just before she left for Palestine, she played the Dvořák Concerto with Kubelik and the Czech Philharmonic. I mean, she was...
In Prague?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. I mean, she was a real rising star as a cellist. She would have had a phenomenal career. And then she then went to Palestine. And then when I was born and then subsequently my sister, my father bought a farm in Africa. So for about 6 years whilst we were in Africa, my mother wasn't playing the cello on the farm in Africa. And she then picked up the cello when she came back to England with us when we were about 6 years old. And that was really when she had to earn a living then, because my parents had split up and she had to earn a living and support us. So then she was playing in the Philharmonia and the English Chamber Orchestra. And she did a lot of playing. So she was a wonderful musician.
Did Kubelik remember her when you played
with
him?
Very much so. Yes. Oh, they remained friends throughout life. And in fact, you know, when he came to Britain, she always used to meet up with him again.
Did you stay at home or were you sent to boarding school among all of these changes?
Well, when we came back to England, we initially went to primary school in Brighton. And then after that, at the age of 7, I went to boarding school.
For how long?
Well, till I was 18. I mean, till A-levels.
And you played in the National Youth Orchestra?
I played in the National Youth Orchestra. I remember that was one of the most mind-blowing experiences of my life. And I mean, when you play in your own orchestra in a small school, you think you're quite a star. And then suddenly, the first day, playing at the first rehearsal of the National Youth Orchestra with the best players in the country, I remember sitting there for the first 10 or 15 minutes. I couldn't play a note. It was Brahms 2. We were just practicing, you know, when the whole orchestra came together. Mm. I just had tears running down my cheeks because it was such an unbelievable sound and obviously nothing I'd ever experienced in my entire life. So, yes, I was there for about 3 years.
And conductors?
Rudolf Schwarz was one of the ones, and he was one of the most moving, but there were a lot of terrific conductors. I mean, I think one of the good things was that they got conductors who really were significant conductors, and people adored working with the NYO as well. But it wasn't so much like it has been in more recent years, where it's some of the greatest conductors will come and spend a short time, but a lot of the preparation is done for them. You know, in those days, the conductor would stay for the whole time, which meant, obviously, I mean, people like Colin Davis or Simon Rattle, I mean, they just couldn't spend the time.
And then university, St Mary's College, to do maths. How long did you last?
Well, about 10 minutes. No, maths and music were my two big loves. So I went to Queen Mary College. But within the first term, I knew I'd made a mistake. I knew I'd done the wrong thing and that I should have gone into music. And so, in fact, I left after one term, practiced the cello, applied to the Royal Academy of Music, and then went to the Royal Academy the next year.
And from the Royal Academy into the Philharmonia?
Straight into the Philharmonia, yes. Well, when I left the Academy, I auditioned for the LSO and the Philharmonia, and I'd always wanted to join the LSO. I'd loved the sort of excitement, the verve. There was something about the LSO which was exciting and entrepreneurial, but they had no jobs at the time. So when I left, I auditioned for the two. The Philharmonia did have a position, and I joined. And in fact, funnily enough, the first period I was there was Otto Klemperer's last Beethoven cycle, and I was sitting next to my mother in the cello section a lot of the time through that cycle. And, you know, it was really sweet. And then just after that 3 months, the LSO phoned up and said, well, somebody's just left. Would you like to join?
Just hang on a moment about the Philharmonia and the Klemperer period, because they were the crack band at that time.
They were a wonderful orchestra. I don't know why, I'd just got it fixed in my head that the LSO, because you're right, I mean, the LSO was not at the
You had joined the elite there.
Yes.
And yet you were prepared to walk out.
Yes.
Was it something about the ethos in the Philharmonia? Did you feel that you didn't quite belong? Was there a bit too much swagger about them?
No, there wasn't. I mean, if anything, the LSO had swagger. You know, not necessarily, legitimately. Funnily enough, the Philharmonia was much more modest. I mean, the LSO was actually a very challenging orchestra in that way, you know, and it was quite aggressive. But for some reason, I had loved the excitement and I loved the entrepreneurial spirit and I loved the creativity about the way they went about life.
Right. It was the Andrepreneurial spirit at that time.
It was Andre,
it?
Yes. It was Andre Previn. And yes, I mean, my first date with the LSO was a big American tour with Andre, you know, doing really tough things like Walton First Symphony. I mean, there were some really, really difficult things I'd never played before. But, you know, and it's the reason I think orchestras' cultures tend to be self-perpetuating is because every orchestra has its own culture, and if you're attracted to it, you're inevitably attracted to what it is that makes it what it is. And so that becomes self-perpetuating because they attract the people who like what they are. And I knew I wanted to belong to the LSO. So it wasn't a question of who was at the top or who wasn't at the top. That was where I wanted to be. And so when the job came up, I didn't have any hesitation. And so after 3 months, I left the Philharmonia and went to the LSO, being offered the job.
So you're 24, 25 years old, and you come into the LSO, which is a big and noisy band with huge characters. And it must have been quite daunting for you.
It was pretty scary. Everybody used to go on about the fact that the LSO is scary, it's aggressive, you know, you don't want to go in there unless you're absolutely sure of yourself because everybody tears you to pieces. It was the friendliest orchestra I'd ever been to. I mean, it was really odd that when I went in there, you know, having auditioned, I did get some freelance work. And it was the total antithesis of what everybody had said. And it was incredibly friendly, incredibly welcoming. And funnily enough, I found the Philharmonia was less so, you know, because there was almost something a bit more aristocratic about it. And people knew their places. In the LSO, there was something much more democratic about, you know, the feeling of belonging.
There are other things that also self-perpetuate. I mean, one of our earliest conversations, you were telling me about a player who had fallen sick and how everybody covered for him and looked after the family and made sure that everything was okay until he got back and until he was playing well and so forth. And that, in the LSO, that still goes on to this day. I still
Absolutely.
Hear this from
it
players.
It is the culture. It's the LSO is a family. That was one of the things I loved about it. People did look after each other, did care for each other, and it was very welcoming and you were genuinely made to feel you were part of it.
It was also the archetype player-owned orchestra, where the manager was going to be second-guessed by the musicians who were his boss. But you knew from your early days in the orchestra and from your early days on the board of the orchestra that the manager is your employee and you have the right to fire him.
Absolutely.
And you did that on occasion. It was necessary. Peter Hemmings had to leave when the orchestra got into trouble. And,
absolutely.
So when the time comes for you to go into management, in a certain sense, in your mind, it must have been a little bit of a step down. You were the boss as the player owner, and now you were going to become, in a certain way, the employee of the player owners.
Well, I mean, it's a very odd position because, in fact, you're employing your employers. I never saw it that way. Firstly, because I'd never wanted to go into management. It's so tough. It's very ungrateful. It's, you know, in those days, the player shareholding thing made it incredibly difficult. I mean, managers tended not to last very long. And a few years later, I was ending up doing it. So, I mean, there was a certain irony in that. But the fact is, I only went into it, firstly, on a temporary basis. I mean, Peter was asked to leave early before the end of his contract because the LSO got into such terrible financial trouble on going into the Barbican.
Let's just talk through the details of that, mm-hmm. Because it almost destroyed the LSO.
It virtually destroyed it.
So in 1982, the LSO moved into the new Barbican Centre as resident orchestra. It was down to play 80 to 100 concerts a year. Many of them repeated along American lines, something that had never been tried in London before. And it became clear pretty quickly that there wasn't an audience for repeated concerts. And within 18 months, you actually had bailiffs at the door demanding money with menaces. That's when your colleagues asked you to become finance director. What actually happened?
The problem was, in the orchestra, we didn't really know a lot of what was going on. I'd been on the board before, and I'd been finance director before, and then I left because Penny and I started an antique business. And so, obviously, as a player, I knew a certain amount what was going on. It was pretty obvious every time you sat in the Barbican and saw a half-empty hall. We weren't doing very well financially. And, I mean, what in fact had happened was, by the time I joined the board again, it turned out, which I didn't know when I was in the orchestra, that the board had already told Peter Hemmings he was going to have to leave early. The situation financially was catastrophic. I don't know the exact figures. I mean, we were probably turning over about 3 million or 3.5 million a year at the most then, and the deficit had risen to about 340,000. And I know Edward Heath got the auditors in to review the position of the orchestra and all of that. And I mean, it was really, really dangerous. Then the orchestra looked for a manager. I mean, they weren't looking to the players to manage it and couldn't find anybody. I mean, probably nobody wanted it. I don't really know, because it was a dangerous time. And so they decided they'd give two players a go, actually just holding the shop, really, for a while, give them a little bit more time to look for a manager. So they asked one player to do 3 months and me to do 3 months. And at the end of my 3 months, I was the second one, they said, would you continue now until we find somebody? And so shortly thereafter, I can't remember, not very much later, they said they couldn't find anybody, so they offered me the job. And I said no for two reasons. One is, you have no idea whether I'm the right person. And secondly, I've got no idea whether I want to do it, because this has never been my aspiration in life. So I said, keep my job open in the cello section for a year. At the end of a year, you'll know if I'm the right person. I'll know if I want to do it. And then we can have that conversation and, you know, we all know where we stand. And at the end of a year, they did offer me the job. I knew I wanted it. But it was such an unimaginable gulf for me. But the issue you mentioned about, you know, you become an employee rather than... It didn't feel like that. Because the fact is, even though the players are the shareholders, in the end, as manager, you're running the organisation. And I guess the thing I'd learnt as a member of the board and as a player was there is no way you run an orchestra where the players are the shareholders without taking everybody with you. So it's not a question of them dictating to you. You've got to define the strategy. You've got to develop the ideas. You've got to involve everybody in that. You have to lead, but you lead through conviction. If you can't convince people, they're not going to go with you. You can't dictate.
Well, how did you know what to do? You go into a company in such crisis, you've never run anything before. What do? You start cutting?
It was a question of trying to analyse everything. First, I mean, I wanted to look at the books, and you actually couldn't tell from the books where we were losing money. So, I mean, I had to set up the financial systems with the guy who was in charge of finance. Because in those days, to be honest, I don't think it was particular to the LSO, I don't think a lot of arts organisations were really professionally run. And we had to do a lot of things which were not desirable. What was interesting, in a way, and what was the huge challenge, was trying to have a picture of long-term objectives And at the same time, obviously, you've got to have short-term remedies. So, you know, it was trying to build a picture of things that were really exciting and important for where one was going to be trying to head. But at the same time, doing a lot of cutting, going to very populist programmes with not enough rehearsal, not always with conductors you wanted to see there, which were things you didn't in a million years want to do, and yet they were totally necessary based on the crisis. So it was a very, very odd combination, and to be honest, not something I was proud of at all. I mean, that first year or two, you know, is not something I would have wanted to hang my name on, except things like the Mile of Vienna and the 20th Century.
Well, that's it, because you have a principal conductor, Claudio Abbado, yeah, who says, we're going to do Mahler in the 20th Century, involving a lot of contemporary music, some of it new to this country.
Yeah, that was in the books before I started.
Yeah, but it wasn't covered. And it wasn't financially
it wasn't paid for. No, not remotely. So, in fact, one of the first things I was asked to do when I came in through the door, the board told me to go to speak to Claudio and get him to cancel this. You know, maybe just do a few Mahler symphonies or do something, but, you know, get rid of all the contemporary stuff, which made it harder to sell. You know, a lot of the major cellists, the whole way it was conceived was unbelievably expensive because it required a huge amount of rehearsal, which is expensive, and so on. So they asked me to do that. I went to see Claudio. Claudio, in his wonderful way, you know, where he never understands English when it doesn't suit him, was great, you know. So when I tried to explain it to him, he just said, I don't understand. And, I mean, it was, you know, he didn't want to understand, and quite rightly, as an artist, he knew what he believed in. And he persuaded me we had to do it. And his view was, if we don't do this, Clive, what does the LSO exist for? And I thought he was right. So I went back to the board and I said, I've talked to Claudio. He is utterly convinced we have to do this. This is critical to the future of the orchestra. He thinks we'll be able to raise sponsorship. I'm convinced we will, because I think it's such an amazing project. So I think we have to do it. And they said, well, are you sure you can raise money? And I said, yes. And of course, I hadn't the slightest idea. I suppose it was the most important lesson I could have learned, which is you've got to go for the things that are remarkable, because then there's a chance you'll raise money. If you go for things that are good, what's going to be exciting about that? So the interesting thing was we did get a lot of sponsorship in. In the end, the orchestra was artistically and financially better off for having done it. It would have been worse off in both ways had we not done it. And it defined my whole attitude to management, which is effectively that money follows vision. You never think about the money first. You think about what do you believe in, what is truly extraordinary, and then how do you make it happen?
In retrospect, it was quite a healthy thing, wasn't it? Because you became one of the pioneers of the mixed economy of state funding and private and corporate funding and creating an arts company that was no longer dependent just on the state and the box office.
Well, I think one of the things I've always felt is that if you're going to achieve something really extraordinary and special, you can never do it on the resources that are available to you. It doesn't matter which country you're in. The resources, you know, can be very good, but very good is never enough. What you need to be is extraordinary. If you're going to be extraordinary, you have got to be entrepreneurial. You've got to find other ways of raising revenues. You've always got to aspire to far more than you can afford. And then you've got to find the route to making that happen. So, yes, we became very entrepreneurial. You know, we became very good at raising sponsorship, very creative about, as you say, the mixed economy. And it set the model for the future. And I guess in many ways, it's so much of what now my life is about in the last 5 years in America, where there is very little state money. Everything is about defining extraordinary visions that totally grab everybody and then finding the way to raise the money. It's got to be one's approach to a job, and I think that's a philosophy, that it always has to be yesterday never matters. The only thing that matters is tomorrow, because if the aspirations aren't way ahead of where you are today, you shouldn't be in the job. Mm. And, you know, that applies to you as a musician if you're playing, and it applies as much, if not more so, if you're running an organisation.
But it became fun.
It became fun in the end. I mean, obviously, there were huge challenges, but most of those were self-imposed. So, I mean, when we took on the thing of creating St. Luke's and creating the Music Education Centre, yes, things like that, I mean, that was raising a vast amount of money for us as an organisation. It was a colossal challenge, and obviously it tested the organisation.
I mean, it's incredibly ambitious scheme for the orchestra. This is an orchestra. They play music. They're not developers. They don't take on a ruined Hawksmoor church of St. Luke's and turn it into an education centre. I mean, you were going way outside the box there.
Yes. But in the end, I think there's only one question you ever ask. It's interesting. When I went to Carnegie Hall, it was exactly the same thing. I always used to find I'd arrive at meetings early on and people would, we'd be talking about a subject, whatever it was, and usually somebody would say, what is the best answer for Carnegie Hall? And I'd always say that's the wrong question. The right question is, what is the best answer for music and what music can do for people's lives? If you ask that question, you'll always come up with the right answer. And effectively, that was what this was all about. I mean, if one thought about the role of the LSO in society, of course, primarily, it's about giving the greatest concerts with the greatest artists to the most extraordinary music. But then if you think more broadly that music is something everybody should be able to participate in, everybody should have the right of access to great music, we're surrounded by some areas where there really is no music and relatively little access to the culture that a lot of us take for granted.
Well, at the Barbican, you're at the edge of some of the poorest areas in London.
Exactly. And so it felt to me as though absolutely central to our philosophy should be what we can put back into society, how we can engage people and create opportunities for people to have the LSO as part of their life.
Has it worked?
I think it has, yes. I mean, look, I've not been there for 5 years, but one of the things I did as well, I mean, there was no education programme at all when I started as manager. So, I mean, long before creating the St Luke's Music Education Centre, we created a music education programme. None of us knew what it actually meant at the beginning. I remember, we started writing up papers and all this sort of thing, and, you know, we knew we believed in education, even though we weren't quite sure what it was. But the fact is, we found our way there. I mean, people like Richard McNichol, there were a lot of people who had done a lot of, yes, animateurs who'd done significant work in this field who we drew in and learned from. And in the end, I think we built a really, really important education
program. And you were talking to schools and clubs and...
Absolutely, and reaching out prisons.
Neighbourhoods,
lots
prisons,
and lots
yes.
of different areas of society who would never normally have access to music. And St Luke's, symbolically, was not in the rich city of London. It was outside in an area which has far more challenges than the city. So all of this, yes, I mean, it was incredibly challenging, but it was just part of what I knew had to be the LSO's role in society. So, yes, of course, it gave us 3 or 4 tough years.
One of your main concerns all the way through was to improve the working lives of musicians, to enable them to become more diverse and to find them a better place in society. And when one looks at the history of the working lives of musicians over the past 100 years, there are probably only 2 orchestral managers who've made that kind of change. The first was Ernest Fleischmann, who managed the LSO in the 60s and died this year.
Yeah.
And Ernest declared, "The symphony orchestra is dead. Long live the community of musicians. Let the orchestra be a pool of talent that can feed the whole of society for its musical needs in whatever shape and form, in different sized ensembles." And then you came along and you said, "Let the musicians of the orchestra have a more diverse life, so that people coming into the orchestra, you would say to them, how much of your life do you want to spend in the orchestra? What else is it that you want to do? And how can we help you achieve that?" So you'd, in a sense, created a model for the musician of the 21st century.
It's certainly what I was trying to do.
A portfolio life.
Yes, trying to create much more of a portfolio career. And I mean, to this day, I think it's true. And in fact, we've created a similar model at Carnegie Hall now. I mean, not
with the orchestra, no,
but a fellowship.
We'll come to that.
A fellowship program, which is all about creating the musician of the 21st century, who I think can contribute in quite a different way.
But when you look at the American orchestras around you, they really are still living in the 19th century.
Well, they're much more...
They are owned by the orchestra.
Yes.
And
they're much more rigid models than, certainly than the London orchestras. But you're right. I mean, what was interesting, again, if you ask the question, what's best for music and the way music can affect people's lives, it's also best for music in people's lives if musicians are always excited, always enjoy what they're doing, always challenged, always stimulated. If they're playing in an orchestra every day of the week and that's all they do, it's much harder for them to feel they have a creative life. And that was why we structured the jobs in that way, so that people could do teaching, they could do chamber music, they could do all sorts of other things, and where we would get the best of them, but also we would attract a very different sort of player. And I think the LSO started attracting fantastic players who probably wouldn't have applied to play in orchestras before,
well,
because
was,
of creating that structure.
It was a time that the chamber music circuit was collapsing in this country, and so a lot of outstanding string quartet players and others came huddling for comfort to the LSO.
Yeah, and loved it, what's more. I was very pleased with that model.
It seems to me that the conductors you had at the LSO fell into 2 types. One is the kind of boys' own heroes, Abbado, Leonard Bernstein, Pierre Boulez, Slava Rostropovich, every cellist's Superman. And the other type was the fail-safe, expert, really hard-working type of music director and guest conductor, Michael Tilson Thomas, Colin Davis, Bernard Haitink. Between these two, the LSO had greater diversity in the podium probably than any other orchestra.
I always felt that the key to any orchestra in the end is the conductors. If you don't have great conductors working with you all the time, you're not making the right demands on the players, it's not the right thing for the audiences. So for me, getting the greatest conductors was always the primary ambition, concern, whatever you want to call it, challenge. And so when I started, in fact, I mean, the LSO did have the reputation I told you about, I mean, for arrogance and so on. There were a lot of conductors who'd said they wouldn't actually conduct the LSO anymore. So, you know, part of my job was actually saying to them, we're not that animal anymore. We really are partners in music making. So there were lots of people. Colin Davis had left. He wasn't going to come back. I mean, Simon Rattle had said he wouldn't come back. I mean, there were lots of people at that time who'd said they would not conduct the orchestra. So sort of convincing all of them that we weren't what they imagined anymore. And obviously the Colin Davis one, I think, was the most important of all, because Colin had decided he wasn't going to come back and conduct the orchestra. And he had actually accepted dates with another London orchestra at the time. And so when I started, I only heard about this then, I didn't realise. And so I went to see Colin and I told him what we aspired to and what we were going to try and do. And I said, please give us a chance. Don't go elsewhere. Try us out. And if we fail, we fail, but give us the chance. And he did. And initially he said to me, oh, Clive, idealists never win. And I said, I promise you, we will do this. We will achieve it. I told him everything we were aspiring to. And so he did agree to stay. And of course, he then ended up as such a fantastic principal conductor for so many years and such a central part of the orchestra's life.
Your success was widely noticed and you were approached with all the best jobs in the land. Every troubled arts company was put on your desk and you were asked to lead. It was Covent Garden, it was the South Bank, it was the Arts Council. Were you ever tempted to move from the LSO to one of those? I mean, Covent Garden was a very real possibility.
No, there were lots of things, and internationally as well, but I was never tempted because I was so engrossed. I mean, I so cared about the LSO. It really was my family. And I just had so many things I wanted to do there that it was never tempting. I mean, there were some interesting conversations and there were times when I thought, actually, this would be really interesting, but I don't think the time is right. And that happened with a couple of jobs where I did have significant conversations and then I thought, it's not the right time for the LSO for me to leave. And, you know, there was one international one that was the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I decided not to, because I wanted to make sure that when the time came that I did leave the LSO, that I'd be leaving it in exactly the right place, you know, where it was really safe for the next person to take it on. And there were other things that obviously complicated it, because for overseas ones, my kids were in school and then university and so on. So, I mean, there were reasons why, and a multiplicity of reasons why, I never was really tempted until Carnegie Hall.
Before you left for Carnegie Hall, you had a good blast at the system and you attacked the Arts Council for not recognising and rewarding excellence and treating everybody on an everyone-shall-have-prizes basis. That's still the same. And the London orchestras still get roughly the same amount of money as each other, regardless of how well they're doing, regardless of whether they rehearse or not.
One of the reasons why I attacked them was because they articulate one thing and do another. It's one thing if, as an organisation, you say, we think everybody should have an equal amount of money, and it doesn't matter whether you do things well or you don't do things well, we'll still give you the same amount of money. Or if you do things extraordinarily, it will make not a significant amount of difference. But if you say that we believe in excellence, we're going to back excellence, but actually it's only words and the deeds don't reflect the words.
That's exactly as it was in your time, and that's exactly as it is in 2010.
Yeah.
They've just brought out another paper on excellence, and at the same time they're still delivering equal measures.
Well, I mean, that was why I was angry, because I think it's fine. If you all say everything should be equal and it doesn't matter what you do, then you know where you stand. But you can't say at one time, we believe in excellence. And I remember Jerry Robinson saying that, you know, and telling me, and I was at a press conference and everywhere, and he said,
Chairman of the Arts Council.
Yeah, when he was chairman of the Arts Council, saying, you know, we are going to back excellence, that we really believe in this. And then absolutely nothing happened. Nothing changed. And that's the thing that upsets me.
Is that the system? Is the system broke?
I don't think
does it need serious reform? We're in a time of great change in this country. Should one of those changes be the whole of the arts funding system, a root and branch reform?
I've never believed in government being directly responsible for arts funding. I mean, I do believe in arm's length funding. So therefore, an arts council, whatever you want to call it, I think that